Ever since soldiers started coming home from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, there's been increased awareness of the traumatic brain injuries and mental health issues that military members take home with them, issues that, in some cases, lead to suicide. In a 2018 report, the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs reported that roughly 6,000 veterans have taken their own lives each year for the last decade or so. These issues aren't unique to the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Soldiers returning home from Vietnam face similar problems, which has had some asking why wasn't the military and the VA better prepared for treating these mental health problems in our most recent wars. Our next guest says the story isn't that straightforward. In a new book, he tells the story of how the military, and the U.S. Army in particular, approached and tried to understand mental health during these wars and how it continues to play out today. David Kiernan is an assistant professor of history and director of the American Studies Concentration at Washington and Jefferson College. His new book is Signature Wounds, The Untold Story of the Military's Mental Health Crisis. David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob. I'm glad to be here.
Well, you in your title, you talk about signature wounds, and you talk about that in your book. This isn't just a medical story or a mental health story or a military story. It's a story about how our culture looks at veterans and active service members and the health issues they face. Talk about the rise of that phrase, signature wounds.
Right. I think it's really important to begin from the idea that the military is part of the larger culture. And when the country goes to war and the military goes to war, Americans have to make sense of what that war means to the nation and what it means to the people who fight. So the concept of a signature wound doesn't mean that that wound is particularly common or the most common wound. It doesn't mean that that wound is something that is new to a particular war, but it means that it's the injury that people grab onto as the one that somehow signifies what's important or unique about this particular conflict. So in the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, it was mental health. It was the idea that soldiers were returning with post-traumatic stress or that they were returning with brain injuries and in some cases that they were taking their lives that really shaped the way many Americans thought about these wars.
You write that the U.S. Army in a lot of ways wasn't prepared for this specific set of problems, in part because they hadn't fought wars like these in a long time since Vietnam. A lot of the experience came out of getting ready for a short, horrific war in Eastern Europe and Central Europe with the Soviet Union. And they weren't prepared for the long deployments that we saw in a place like Iraq or Afghanistan. Talk about what all of that meant for the Army's preparedness to deal with mental health concerns.
Well, these are the first wars that the United States has fought with an all-volunteer military. They're the first wars that the United States has fought that required multiple deployments of the same people. So you had people deploying for 9 months, then 12 months, then 15 months as the wars got longer, and returning home for a shortening amount of time, 12 months and then 9 months. And so one of the questions that the Army really hadn't thought through until the wars began and had to understand as the wars were happening was, what are going to be the psychological impacts of sending somebody on a second deployment or a third deployment or maybe even a fourth or fifth deployment? And so that was really the key issue of dealing with a relatively small military that's going to be taxed an extreme amount over the course of wars that, if you lay them end-to-end from 2001 to the present and you count Iraq and Afghanistan, about a quarter century of battle that comes down to about 1.5 million years of deployments.
You are contesting in your book one idea that I think came out a lot in the news and politics surrounding the war, and often from veterans themselves, the idea that the Army and the VA were indifferent, negligent, didn't care about mental health, didn't care about traumatic brain injuries. What do you see as a more accurate way to represent what those hierarchies, those institutions did?
Well, from very early in the wars, both the military and particularly the Army, which is what I spend most of the book writing about, and the Department of Veterans Affairs were very keenly aware that soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines were going to return from these wars and were going to, in many cases, have some readjustment issues. Sometimes they would be minor, sometimes they would be major, sometimes they would be ones that would resolve on their own, and sometimes they would be ones that required some sort of treatment. So the idea that the military was indifferent to these issues is simply not correct. What is more accurate to say is that they had to spend a lot of time learning as the wars were happening what the nature of the problems they faced were and what the best treatments were, how to implement those treatments and how to make them accessible. Pete Guerin, who was Secretary of the Army from 2007 on, phrased it to me in an interview. He said it was the equivalent of changing the wheels on a bus while the bus is going 60 miles an hour down the highway. There was a lot of learning as they went that they had to do and figuring out what the right course of action was going to be.
Talking to David Kieran, author of the new book Signature Wounds, The Untold Story of the Military's Mental Health Crisis. One of those reinventions, the changing the wheels on the bus you just mentioned, David, was trying to overcome a stigma when it came to mental health issues. People in charge may not have wanted to acknowledge them in some cases, and individual soldiers in the Army in this case might have had fears about revealing what they were going through. What kind of culture change did Army leaders try to bring about?
Right. The military, much like American culture, and I think it's really important to remember that as a culture, Americans have a pretty stigmatized view of mental health. It's hard to admit and acknowledge a mental health issue. And the Army's no different in that the Army is a culture that prizes toughness. It's a culture that prizes the ability to thrive in difficult situations. And so for a lot of soldiers, it was difficult to acknowledge first to themselves and then in some cases to their fellow soldiers and to their superiors that they were struggling. And some superiors were really reluctant to take those issues seriously initially. So the Army had to work on a cultural level to normalize the idea that people who go to war are going to have a psychological response to it, and that it is normal to have that kind of response, and that it is also beneficial to somebody to seek and get treatment, and that a person can, in many cases, in most cases, return to their previous level of mental fitness and go on to continue in their career and return to their family life and so on as a result of getting that kind of treatment. So that the military had to work on making care more accessible, and it had to make the idea of acknowledging and then seeking treatment more accessible, more acceptable, rather.
David, you mentioned that the U.S. Army, the U.S. military is part of American culture, but part of the story you tell is of a separation there, too, where the burden, if you will, is on the people who are in the military and their families, maybe on certain communities, and the rest of American society is isolated, distant. Is that an important part of the story as we try to figure out what happened and how to do better in the future?
I think that's a crucial part of the story, that about 0.5% of Americans serve in the military. And if you include military families, that only gets to about 1%. So very few Americans have military experience. Very few Americans know somebody who's in the military. And the result of that is that the culture has been able to go along during these wars without really thinking a whole lot about what these wars meant to the nation and how they impacted the people who were actually serving. And so I think a key issue I try to get at in the book is saying that the culture needs to pay more attention to the military and to the people in the military and ask what those experiences have been and what they mean for the people who serve, because when we ask those questions, we'll be able to make better decisions about what we ask our servicemen to do in the future.
We continue our conversation with David Kieran, author of the new book Signature Wounds, The Untold Story of the Military's Mental Health Crisis. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about how doctors, healthcare providers, military leaders approached mental health care in the nation's most recent wars? Are you a veteran of those wars yourself? What did you hear? What messages did you get from leadership when it came to taking care of mental health? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go to a caller now. Bill is with us in Wakefield. Bill, hello.
Hello. Thank you very much for taking my call. Yeah, I had my grandfather and various uncles and cousins and some Vietnam vets that I've helped out and caretake for. And so definitely something that's got kind of pushed aside, and a lot of them coke with alcohol and various things, but definitely a very serious issue that kind of never got taken care of, and they just isolated you once you did have the problem.
Bill, thanks for the call. David, substance abuse issues Bill sees in his family, was that a concern for the American military people, I guess, self-medicating when they had PTSD or other problems?
That was an issue of very serious concern to the military. The soldiers would go on deployments, and of course they couldn't drink on their deployments. They were in a country where alcohol was largely unavailable, and then they would return home, and reintroducing alcohol into their lives could sometimes be an issue for those soldiers. In the case that they would go out and they would come home and blow on a blow off steam and go out and party and have fun and celebrate that they'd returned, and sometimes that would lead to alcohol misuse or alcohol abuse. And what the Army realized was that any kind of substance abuse, whether it was alcohol abuse, whether it was abuse of prescription drugs, whether it was abuse of illicit drugs, was often an indicator that a soldier was struggling with some other issue that they hadn't resolved from a mental health perspective. And sometimes it was the first indication that a soldier might be sliding down a slope towards suicidal behavior. So addressing substance abuse issues and making sure that there were substance abuse treatment options available was something the Army worked very hard to try to make a change on.
Bill, thanks a lot for that call. Before we go to another caller, David, I want to talk about traumatic brain injuries. You've got a whole chapter in the book about this, and this was a medical and military mystery. Can you talk about how that story developed?
Sure. So it's really important that we understand that when the military goes to war, they go to war largely with the same medicine that civilians have. So when the military goes to war in 2001 and 2003, they take with them the civilian understandings of concussion. And at the time, the civilian understandings of concussion, which might be familiar to anybody who's played a contact sport, were that if a person wasn't displaying any symptoms after they'd had a hit to the head, they could rest for a day or so, or maybe even a few hours, and then go back and return to the game. It turns out that there's a lot of research that's come out of these wars and out of research that the Army's done in tandem with other institutions that shows that there's a real danger in multiple concussions and a second concussion before the first one's healed. But the Army wasn't aware of this. That research really wasn't extant at the onset of the wars, and it was something, again, they had to do research on and learn while they were fighting these wars. And the second issue around traumatic brain injury was the question of whether the explosive wave of a blast could damage the brain even if the person had not had a physical impact. Up until 2001 and 2003, there really wasn't research that showed this. In fact, it wasn't until the middle of the first decade of this century that researchers began to understand that there was going to be neurological damage from the explosive wave of the blast. So, as with many things, there was a lot of gaps in the research that had to be filled in as military clinicians and leaders realized that they were facing problems that they hadn't anticipated and hadn't seen before.
And so for a soldier caught in the blast radius of an improvised explosive device, you might not see a visible wound. For a soldier detonating a demolition charge to open a doorway, they might all be subjected to repeated concussions like that, but nobody had recognized that that was an issue up to this point.
That's right. There was some research being done on it. There was some speculation about it. But what's really true is that up until these wars, the body armor that soldiers wore wasn't sufficient to protect them from injuries from a blast where they would be that close and to be affected by the blast wave. So when, as body armor improves, soldiers start returning home and complaining of sleeplessness, of irritability, of a variety of symptoms that they attribute to having been close to the explosion and affected by the blast wave. And so the military had to figure this out, and it raises a whole host of other questions. Well, how close do you have to be? How big was the explosion? If you are wearing your helmet, is there a difference with that? And so it really was a big issue of uncertainty that the military has grappled with and continues to grapple with as they try to determine exactly under what circumstances is a soldier likely to be injured by the explosive wave of a blast.
I want to bring on another caller now. Brian joins us from Park Falls. Brian, hello.
Hey, guys. Thanks for doing this show. This is pretty darn awesome, and I really love the section on TDI that you just did. Before I get to my point, I got blown up 6 times when I was in Afghanistan, and I ended up being a lab rat for a pituitary gland study over at the Puget Sound VA. And I mean, they ran a bunch of medical tests on me, and they have me on a dose of human growth hormone that's starting to help with the pituitary gland damage. But anyways, back to my point, I've had about 4 or 5 of my friends commit suicide in the past 5 years. And you know, the biggest thing that I noticed about the mental health issues that we're having is it was all the guys that killed themselves. I mean, it was 3 of them in a three-week period in 2014. All of them were the rock solid dudes in my unit. Like the guys that you never expected that to happen to. You know, the guys that would talk about their problems and, be able to really, work their way through it and go and get help and stuff. They were the ones that are fine. The ones that were having trouble. I mean, heck, my old first sergeant, we had to track him down. He was in L.A. homeless and smoking meth. And, but he was the rock solid dude. And, those are the guys that I'm really having to start, really having to worry about now is those fellas that, they didn't talk about it. And, they were there for everybody else. And then, all of a sudden, 4 or 5 years down the road, they're, killing themselves.
Brian, thank you so much for sharing your story. I'm sorry about the loss of your friends, and thank you for looking out for the rest of them back home now. David, a powerful story there. What does that make you think about?
Well, I want to echo Brian. That's a terrible loss to have endured, so my sympathies. You know, this is something the Army saw a lot with veterans when they returned, that the people who, to use Brian's phrase, were the rock-solid guys, were the people who would sometimes have struggles when they got home. And one reality of the military experience is that the skills that you develop in the military to withstand a deployment, and particularly a combat deployment, are often not skills that are adaptable to the home environment. The things you need to do to survive in Iraq or Afghanistan, if you're in a combat unit, can often be unhealthy behaviors, the ability to control your emotions and keep them inside and not let your feelings interfere with your ability to do your work is something that's very useful if you're in a combat situation, but it's something that really can be detrimental when you come home and you don't then talk about what you've experienced and address the impact of what you've experienced. So I think what's really important is to say to veterans and to say to soldiers that it is absolutely normal to return from a deployment and have a period of reintegration and have a period where you are going to have to work through some of the things you've experienced, and that you need to do that and you need to work through that, because when you don't, those issues will compound and they will lead to greater problems down the road and sometimes, unfortunately, to suicide.
Thanks again for that call. David, in just our last minute, is that happening? Is that message being sent to service members while they're deployed, after their deployment, that they can seek help, it's good to seek help, and that help is available?
The military's gotten so much better on the issue of mental health over the course of the past 2 decades, and I think it's really important to recognize that and to take the important lessons that they've learned, such as making sure that there's a mental health provider embedded in each unit and making sure that provider knows those soldiers, making sure that leaders know what's going on in their soldiers' lives and are ready to intervene if they see a soldier struggling. Those are big changes that have happened. Are they perfect? Absolutely not. Is there still a lot that needs to be done? Is there still research that needs to be funded? Absolutely. But there have been great gains, and I think the important lesson as we look at the end of these 2 decades is that we need to continue to invest in that research and continue to promote a culture of mental health.
David, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for sharing your research with us today.
It's my pleasure, Rob. Thank you for having me.
That's David Karen, Assistant Professor of History and Director of the American Studies Concentration at Washington and Jefferson College. His new book is Signature Wounds, The Untold Story of the Military's Mental Health Crisis. By the way, if you or someone close to you is having thoughts of suicide, I just want to give you the suicide hotline number, put it out there. That number is 800-273-8255. Again, 800-273-8255.